Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, March 27th, 2004. Today's session is entitled Food, the fourth practice for the Lutheran Outdoor Ministry Association retreat. Session number LOMA 2004-04. Let's listen in.
On to food.
Yes.
I don't know if it was intentional that just before a food session you get this big dose of onions. Did anyone have
that?
Major onion. For a song to begin us off, I was thinking, I think Dan's going to probably talk about a different text, but I was thinking about Isaiah 55, where this text that we have coming up with the Easter Vigil on, for everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. All you have no money, come eat. Listen carefully, eat what is good, and delight yourselves in good food. So this is a song based on that text. And there's no music for it. You just need to sing this line. Come to the waters. Sing that.
Come to the waters.
Come to the feast.
Come to the feast.
So first I'll sing, then you.
Come to the waters.
Then I'll sing a line and then you sing back. So first I'll sing, then you.
Come to the waters.
Then I will sing, you follow.
Come to the feast.
And then we'll do it again.
Come to the waters.
First I will sing, you follow.
Come to the feast.
That's the first half of the song. The second half, you start by singing this line. For this is life.
For this is life.
Now sing that same line again.
For this is life.
You sing it one more time.
For this is life.
The song is almost over. Oh, come to the feast.
Oh, come to the feast.
So now you know it. All right.
Before you begin, I have another set of introductions
After Dan does his reflection, the response, instead of Tom and Margie immediately, will be our two food coordinators. This is Katie Kula and Sonia Sharp. You have to have an alliterative name to be coordinated. And they'll tell you as they speak a little bit about their background. But we've been very intentional about the food philosophy at Holden to really basically embody the values of that song in terms of celebration and health and justice. And so we'd like to share a little bit of what we do before we start the general exchange.
Before I begin, this is, I don't know if you're ever interested in fundraising ideas, but I have a niece in Idaho who's a soap maker. So for the Luther Heights Bible Camp that's in the Sawtooth Mountains, she made the soap, and then I made a label for it, and it's Luther soap. And it has a picture of Luther in a bathtub and with the date AD 1525, which is the year he was married and therefore probably took a bath. Lutherans just really bought this because it was, they wanted to give it to all their friends, and the Luther Heights made $6,000 on this soap sale. So. I don't know if it's interested in money. You can pass it around.
You don't have samples to try out?
No. I don't think Lisa would make, you know, thousands of bars of soap. If you have a soap maker, I can sure you could sure use the picture. As a basis for our discussion about food, I'm going to go to a part of the Bible that we seldom ever read or study, but it is so food-oriented, and it's Daniel 1. And Lindy's going to read this, and this is one of those passages that if you're a lay reader hopes he or she never gets because of the names. But I told her to read them with confidence. But I'll read the first three verses, which is the first part of the book of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. And these he brought to the land of Shinar and placed the vessels in the treasury of his gods. Shinar was an old word for Babylon. And there's an interesting story behind this, that he took the vessels and put it on his storage shelves, because when the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar conquered another kingdom, he would take the idols from their temple, the statues, and put them on shelves in the special showroom. And then, frustrated when he got to Jerusalem, there were nothing to take of any statues. So he took implements from the temple to put on his shelf, probably was placed on the lowest of the shelves just to be a further insult to the Jewish people. Of course, now Daniel was written many years after Babylon, but this is the memories and the story of Daniel. While it reflects the time in Babylon, was probably written in maybe the 2nd century BC in the Greek era. But listen to this passage now, and I'll just give you a clue. It's about food.
Then the king commanded his palace master Ashpenaz to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve in the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years so that at the end of that time, they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, and Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine. So he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your own age, you would endanger my head with the king." And then Daniel asked the guard whom the palace master had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. You can then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men who eat the royal rations and deal with your servants according to what you observe." So he agreed to this proposal and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was observed that they appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations.
Is that 17?
16.
Oh.
So the guard continued to withdraw their royal rations and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom, and Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams.
Okay, thank you. That was fine, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All those words. So. Now the question might be, what does this have to do with food at outdoor ministries? And in a Bible study, now if we had an hour, it'd be fun to kind of bring this all out. But I'll just read a few thoughts from this passage, and then we can our kitchen leaders can then tell us how this fits into the whole thing. Are you ready for this? So, what's going on food-wise? But first, it is Jewish people who are in a hegemony or a great political and cultural power. The Israelites are a minority people who are exiles in Babylon. And the plan of the Babylonians here in the story seems to be assimilation, not by force or by the power of the sword, but by gradual cultural assimilation. And the first is to change their names from their Jewish names that all have the God of Israel in the name to Babylonian names that all have the Babylonian gods, three different Babylonian, or four, I mean, for the four Jewish people. And it reminds me of the old movie Roots, when they gave him a new name when he came here as a slave, and you remember his cry, "My name is Kunta Kinte." And then they tried again to give him his new name. Then the other ways of assimilation was to teach them the language, to teach them the literature, so the stories of Babylon would replace the stories of Israel. And then, so that was a 3-year period, then a Babylonian indoctrination. And then this would lead to power and status for them. And then a major way of assimilation was to change their eating. And so it was commanded that this food master. What was he called in the text? I forgot. Palace master. The palace master now is going to serve them the king's food instead of the food they are accustomed to. And now food in the Bible, as we know, is much, much more than putting nourishment into your body like you would put fuel into your car. Being assigned the royal rations now, here we have an act now of civil disobedience that Daniel works out with the palace master. And then Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will eat only vegetables. And they talk the palace master into this, and he agrees. So now the fear is his neck if they turn out after a week to look not as healthy as the people that eat the king's food. So here I just have four kind of things about food that is going on in this passage. Number one, food is a great step in enculturation into another culture. To eat the food of that culture is to become that culture. There's power in this. Then eating the king's food, and by the way, the other thing that's going on here is kosher food that and that's kind of argued by scholars because even the vegetables might not be kosher, so it's argued how important that is in the story. But then eating the king's food, this is the second point. Actually, I have five. Eating the king's food ends tableship with their own people. They have now left their own people and the way food calls them together and solidifies them. Eating in the way one eats has great political significance as whether you're the in-group or the out-group. And then it goes against the lessons of manna in the wilderness that has always been in the Jewish story. And that is that everyone eats equally, although that wasn't often kept, it was in the story. That is the manna in the wilderness, we eat equally. Then the next, eating the king's food is like a return to Egypt, to be in a society where the king and now the king's people that they are tempted to become receive the sumptuous food, and then the common people eat very, very plain. This would be like a return to the great gap between those in power and those out of power in the Egypt that they left. Next, eating the king's food breaks the Jewish biblical pattern of common food, simple food being the daily diet, with an occasional feast. And then at the feast, you bring out the king's food for everyone. And then you go back to the common food. And now this is breaking that pattern where now they will have the festival food every day. And then finally, it ends the sense of thanksgiving. Because if these four now Jewish people begin to eat the king's food, it ends Thanksgiving. Because that food no longer comes from God, but it comes from the king in whom they are then indebted to. So do you notice how all the biblical themes of food are going on in this delightful, I think, Daniel's story. So that's the input on food, and I love the book of Daniel. I don't know why. When I was born, my father was at a ministerial meeting and at the Methodist parsonage, sitting under a picture of Daniel in the lion's den. So that's how I got the name. bring me back to Daniel. So do you want to, you don't have to respond specifically to this, but it's supposed to lay out some themes.
Great, of the, yeah. We're going to start just by reading the Holden Village food philosophy. We make copies for everyone. Because we know some people are visual learners. I think there should be enough for almost everyone, but we're getting low, some people need to share. So I'll start reading it while it's being passed around. And this is what I mean by food philosophy for those that maybe need a little clarification of that is when Sonia and I and the village and the community make decisions about day-to-day menuing, season-to-season menuing, and budgetary decisions, this is our mission statement of sorts for those kind of decisions. Especially because there's a lot of turnover year to year, it kind of keeps things consistent. So I will read it. The Holden kitchen is shaped by the conviction that our shared meals contain sacramental elements. When we gather at a common table, we understand that eating is more than simple refueling. We recognize that our food choices have significant consequences for those who gather food and for the earth that brings it forth. At the same time, the Holden kitchen wishes to celebrate and to uphold the gift and blessing of God's nourishment. We are committed to serving food that is healthy, celebrative, and not harmful to other people or the earth. Holden serves a diet that emphasizes whole grains, fresh fruits and vegetables, legumes and nuts. We seek out suppliers that support workers rather than corporations. We use leftovers creatively and strive to eliminate waste. We hope that the weekly menu mirrors the lively conversation that occurs throughout the village. We welcome those who come to Holden to be both challenged and refreshed. We hope that our shared meals are a significant part of that experience.
Okay. As they said, my name is Sonia, and before I start, I just wanted to say that I worked at several camps, including Sky Ranch, and it's really fun to see all you here. I thought even before I knew you were coming that it would be a neat connection to make, so I'm glad you all are here. I'll just start with, when we gather at the common table, we understand that eating is more than simple refueling. One of the ideas that not just the Holden Kitchen has, but Holden in general has, is that gathering around a table is part of our hospitality, and that there's great sense of community that can form as you gather around a table. So that's been part of when we're creating meals, we think about that as well, and we like, it's just wonderful to see that happen when you put out a meal, and that happens. So that's one of the parts I wanted to come in at first.
And part of that, too, is that, yes, it is joyful to eat together and have good conversation and good food, and we believe that it increases the joy and the sacramental aspect of that to also know that the food that we are serving has been grown and shipped and prepared in a way that respects God's gift of creation and God's people. And so, practically speaking, that means that we seek out, as it says, we seek out sources of food that come, as much as possible, we like to work directly with people producing food. Today that's difficult, especially living in a remote mountain community at the end of a boat on a lake. We do work a lot with major distributors of food like Sysco, but we've sought out over the last couple of years especially to have relationships with local organic farms. So in the summer, a huge portion of our produce is being grown by people who live right on Lake Chelan in Leavenworth and in Twist, Washington, the farthest away of which I think is like 90 miles. And these are people that we know, and we know their practices. They're all preparing or growing food for us in certified organic methods. And we also purchase beef and chickens and some meat products from those some of those farmers and other farmers. So then when we make this meal and we serve it and we're gathered around this table, it's like a complete sacrament in our minds that we can enjoy it on our taste buds, we can enjoy the conversation, and further not have any of, I hate the word guilt, but it's free of guilt. This is a complete pleasure fest. And Sonia and I really have enjoyed this year planning, especially for our big celebration meals, like Christmas dinner. Almost every single item we served was from an organic distributor. And that's hard to do in December. So, because a lot, you know, farms are covered in snow. But we had squash and potatoes that we were storing in some cold rooms in the village, and to bring those out and have this big celebration was fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that has been really just wonderful for the village and for us has been that we've gotten to know the people that grow our food, and there's a weekend in the fall where we invite them up to come, and we have apple pressing, and we have a big feast and just kind of celebrate and get to know people. There are young people that are working on farms that are our age. There are older farmers, and they all come up and get to know each other a little bit. And so it was a real blessing to know, for them to know where their food is going and for us to know where we're getting our food. So that's been really exciting as well.
And to tie it into the reading and the message, too, it's a joy to feel like choosing to purchase and serve foods is a way of acting today, when sometimes actions can feel difficult or almost impossible in the face of a lot of larger corporate power. By deliberately choosing to purchase different foods, we, like Daniel and the others, are saying no to a system that Holden has decided we don't want to support or would like to support as little as possible. And so that is a really powerful feeling, to know that we can actually do something that makes a difference. Even if it's small in the scheme of things, we have, I mean, even more than individual homes making purchasing decisions about their food, here we can see the huge difference it makes when you make those little differences. For example, last summer, a farm just down the road from one of our farms that supplies us with a lot of organic produce had a lot of pears, organic pears that they wanted to sell at a really cheap price. That's all we knew, that this woman had 2,000 pounds of pears at a great price. So we thought, let's buy them all and can them for the winter. Well, it turns out later, this woman every year has difficulty selling her produce, and every year almost gives up on her farm. And this year didn't, because we purchased 2,000 pounds of pears from her. And so she's still in the farming business and isn't going to burn her trees. And that's amazing to actually see the cumulative effect of 450 people living in the wilderness eating differently. And then if you think, that could happen in cities and towns all over the country, and maybe we wouldn't see it the same way, but it would have the same effect.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I was thinking of as she was talking was, it seems like when I came here, I was really excited about how much Holden Village has committed to this and how many, you know, farms we are connected with and things like that. And it may seem pretty daunting to start out on something like this, but I know that it's been done. I mean, it took hard work, but it's been done incrementally. And for example, like this year, we've decided, let's try to purchase all organic milk. So when we budget, we added that in, but we weren't able to do everything all at once. So if it seems kind of like, well, this is a pretty large undertaking, it is, but it didn't happen, you know, but through the work of just one person, or just through the work of, oh, let's just go organic, and, you know, certainly we still buy a lot of things that are not organic, and we still buy a lot of things from Cisco or Big Corporation, but each year we're trying to, you know, make more progress in that area.
A little bit about Holden's Food Service.
I think I'll just underscore, because I'm very sensitive to the fact that we do not want to sound like we're doing it right. This has definitely been a process of each year, usually at budget time, the kitchen goes through proposing a new step, both in terms of consciousness raising as well as in our purchasing and everything else. And so it's definitely been one step at a time, and we still have a long ways to go. It's not at all to, I feel very proud and really good of our food philosophy and the action, the political statements that it embodies. And it's not without cost. Mm-hmm. And I don't just mean the financial cost, the people that have problems with eating alternatively becomes sometimes challenging. You say our children have absolutely nothing to eat. But anyway, fortunate.
Comments, thoughts, ideas.
Are you using equal exchange, like coffee and those sorts of things?
Yeah, actually, Holden has been serving fair trade coffee for about almost 20 years. Long before we were doing a lot of organic things in our produce, we were serving fair trade coffee at least.
I just think so much of what, in terms of food philosophy and stuff, it's not also just purchasing and preparation, but the manner of serving. So many of young people never sit down with other people or as a family to eat. Mm-hmm. Families don't eat together anymore. And this whole opportunity to, together with that family for the week, sit down and eat together and have conversation, you know, is an extremely important ministry that we do.
I know it, coming up here a lot, that sitting down at a table and sharing food with other people, some of whom you don't know, and now at round tables there, has become really important for me. And I realize its effect on my life of, you know, a serving dish and being conscious that it goes around the table and everyone gets some, and then they're negotiating who's going to go and get more and how much you need, how many want more, and being aware of other people's needs as you sit at the table has been really important for me. And it's also why I think I'll always be opposed to Holden adding more buffets, just because I think buffet eating is, you lose that sense a little bit of the sacramental nature of food sharing, and it becomes kind of an individual act of grabbing food versus sharing food with one another. But I know all the arguments for buffets, that there's a lot of things that's just easier, but there's something about a family style meal that seems important here.
It's kind of interesting to see the food service here, because I think I deal with food service that's, you know, being regulated by the state. You know, and how and what we can do. You know, they hear you canning pears, which, you know, that would just be.
It's regulated.
I mean, we can't even pass food around the table, and you can't go up for seconds without taking a clean tray. You know, we have to deal with those kind of government regulations, which get in the way of some of the aspect of what you provide.
So you cannot serve family style anymore? Mm. I noticed when I was there that you had gone to cafeteria and a kind of, you know. How many are the rest? Are there some of the rest of you regulated where you cannot serve family style by state health code?
Mm-hmm. Wisconsin's got one of the toughest in the country.
I knew.
There's some things.
How many of you are serving family style primarily?
On occasion.
We still do, but there's, you know, anything that goes off the other side of the counter has to be tossed. There's no reusing it, no taking it back to the kitchen.
That's more expensive.
So it's a matter of, you know, and you're supposed to pass out little plastic gloves to each person if they have to reach for something or make sure there's tongs. I mean, it's, you can't really even make s'mores in Wisconsin unless you have little plastic gloves at the campfire to touch the graham crackers and stuff. So it's ludicrous.
Is it a buffet line too, that if it's out there then, because even if a sneeze bar, that has to be thrown too?
That's what doesn't make sense to me, because no.
Sounds like a First Amendment issue.
Yeah.
It takes a sacramental. Take it to the Supreme.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about your baking and doing so much of what you cook from scratch. Mm-hmm. And how you see that, how it fits into the philosophy, kind of the pros and cons maybe that go along with that style of food preparation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the cons that I can see would be it takes longer, you have to maybe have the knowledge of how to put everything together, but in terms of the pros, I think it's almost always more healthy for you. And I think taking care of our bodies is just such a basic thing that we need to do. I mean, we should do as we've been given our bodies. So those are two things that pop into my head right away. Just, wow. And just, it's hard to explain, but if you've ever worked with food, making it from scratch, there's something that's very gratifying, and you feel like you're preparing something like that, and then giving it to other people is great. I enjoy it a lot.
It's also cost effective. Mm-hmm. We save, I think, probably a lot of money cooking from scratch. Our labor is probably the cheapest ingredient in our kitchen. And I don't mean that by demeaning it, but just we can use that wisely. And I think it also empowers our kitchen staff to be cooking from scratch rather than opening it and putting it in the oven. There's variations on not from scratch, but so it makes a lot of sense that way. And it is just a lot healthier. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything, not across the board, but in general, you could safely say that a meal made from scratch will contain less salt, sugar, and fat than one that includes processed foods.
Mm-hmm. And then you can know everything you put into it, and there aren't a lot of as many mysteries.
That can be. Yeah. And it helps us eliminate waste, too. Every single meal we make, we tailor how much we make to how many people will be at that meal. 15 people makes a difference as to how much we'll make, so
yeah,
that's a big issue, especially because waste disposal is difficult here, and we really see how much we didn't eat when we take it up to compost it. So.
Diana is very brave, because I have a feeling you could have a job at probably 17 different I know the challenge that some of us have had over the years is wanting to do everything from scratch and trying to find cooks to do that. Some people have year-round. I was blessed to always have that. But boy, if you're especially just hiring summer cooks, and then you're looking at school cooks, and the challenges out there with staffing.
Yeah.
in the kitchen.
So do you ever have any flops? baking bread and bread products is, I mean, you have to know what you're doing.
That's
ruin the whole batch, you know.
yeah, that's probably our most consistent output.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Janet, you know the story. You made me know.
Oh, you were
there.
Oh,
I wasn't here.
Oh, boy. It's a bigger story than just food. A year ago, about now, we had a number of individuals, staff members, who were smoking marijuana, and we saw an agreement that is something we will not do here. And so, was it 6 of the 8 kitchen staff left us because of that? And so we had several new people in the kitchen covering for them for the month period of time that we asked them to be away from here. And one day, they'd made bread, and I came into the dining hall, and somebody said, Janet, you have to come to the kitchen. What are we going to do for lunch? And I said, what's wrong with the bread? Well, apparently, there had been a big jug of oil that they used in the bread, big, great big jug, unlabeled, and there had been, and that was gone. So they sent somebody off to get another jug of it, and they saw one in the dish pit area that looked just like it, so they brought it in.
Oh.
It was soap. They put soap in the bread. They only discovered that. I think they did it one day and we didn't even know it.
Yeah, but it was
one day. They discovered it because the next day they were cooking some beans. And the beans started just foaming. Finally they figured out it was soap. Nobody got sick. You know, we had crackers that day. But So, once in a while.
Yes. What kinds of comments, I mean, did the guests, you said that people said something about there was nothing for their children to eat, or do you get much response from your clientele?
Probably food is the single most commented on item on our evaluations that everybody fills out. And they are, in vast majority, I know that when the kitchen looks at the evaluations and the one that says, I didn't have anything to feed my children, you know, it sort of jumps out and overwhelms everything. But for the most part, our food is greatly appreciated. I think that one of the best compliments we ever got is a family that came that had been here before, and they had heard this reputation about, you know, no snack food, and it's hard for kids to eat, etc. I drove the bus down the lake, and a woman was going out with a grocery bag full of potato chips and processed food and so on, and unopened. It was all going down, and I teased her that that's very unusual. Most people bring it in and it disappears, or they leave it with the staff or something like that. And her little boy, looked about 10, was next to her, and she said, I heard that it was going to be difficult for my children to enjoy the food. And so I came prepared. That's what I was advised to do. The little boy was next to her, and he said, but the food here is awesome. And they didn't open their bags. And I would say that is definitely the majority of the response. There are a few people, whether it's adults who say, I need my meat and potatoes every day, or whether it's a child that won't eat at the table because they're not accustomed to food from scratch. And I don't know, Janet, Molly, Christopher, anybody else want to comment? I mean, I know that you guys get a little sensitive to this because criticism sometimes is out of proportion. But for the most part, I think the teaching aspect of food here is really valued. And in terms of young staff and hiring, I think some people, the kitchen is a very desirable place to work. And I think a part of it has to do with the values that are embodied in the food and the way that they appeal to young adults that they can be a part of the food process, that they feel really unique and special and proud of. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
My father-in-law is a, raises beef cows, and he's a strong evangelical Christian. When I tell him about coming to Holden, I'm sure he's going to ask that question. So there really wasn't any meat on it. Why is it? So give me the answer that you would provide. You would provide a Wally, because he would probably point out. It might not have been less expensive to have served the beef, or maybe that's one of the driving forces. But
no, actually, it costs more money.
It sounds like, yeah.
But
you can tell them that this winter community ate almost 3 cows, but beyond that, we bought 3 cows at the beginning of the winter. We've gone through a lot of that meat, but. I don't eat very much meat.
I mean, part of it is that, meat takes up more resources, if you're feeding a cow, it's the grain and water, and water that you use to go to the grain. So just, it takes up more resources, so that we don't want to say we're not ever going to have meat, because we enjoy meat. My husband loves meat. So we have meat usually two or three times a week. But we try to limit that in part because of the extra resources that it does take. That's mm-hmm. one of the reasons.
Resources that could be used to produce many more calories for consumption than the resulting calories of the same resources that go into beef production. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the book Diet for a Small Planet, but that's kind of the main theory of that book, and it has a lot of facts and figures about the amount of water, the amount of grain, and so.
And I think in the United States we're really accustomed to eating a lot of meat, and that's not the case in other areas of the world, and just relating it to what you were talking about, just if you have meat for more like a couple times a week, or it's a special thing, then you really appreciate it, and it's become something that we have maybe on Sundays, and it's everybody's excited, or the meat eaters are excited anyway. Not everybody. So it's something that can be celebrative, and that's another aspect of it.
Do you normally have some education, like with the children in the summer, about the food? I mean, so they're learning. Some of us have been able to do that, incorporated into the program with our, camp learning times and things. I just wondered here.
We do a lot of education in the summer for the village as a whole, not necessarily any one particular group of villagers, but we do it through a couple of ways. In the summer, one of the bulletin boards that now has the winter safety information on it, the kitchen puts information about our diet, where our ingredients come from, nutrition in general, and just a lot of issues about food, and then resources is to where you get more information about the food philosophy. And then we also hold weekly food forums on the ARC, just come out and talk about food, and then once a month we have a larger forum in here. And this spring, Sonia and I are working on a video with footage of our 3 local farms that provide us with food that was actually shot 2 summers ago, but never finished. And so we're going to finish that video, and that'll be a really useful tool, just a really easy way to get people to come down and learn more about our food and be a comprehensive little 20-minute intro to our food philosophy.
What about your Youth Weekend module that you're going to do?
In May, we have groups of high school students that come for weekends at a time, and then they go to different sessions, and it's all based on a book called The Way to Live. Do you read that something? Never mind. And so Katie and I are, and this has been done in the past also, but we're doing a session on food, and we'll be talking about just doing some activities that raise awareness about where the food comes from. What's the difference between maybe the way one apple is raised and the other kind, and the working conditions and things like that. So. What we're hoping in that session too, and I touched on this earlier, is to give a sense of empowerment. I think so often when people get the activist bug or start to realize that maybe some things need to be changed in this world, there's such a feeling of powerlessness. And food is one thing that you can really change in your life. And so we're really excited about working with the high schoolers on that level, because I feel like especially when you're young and you're hearing these messages about environmental causes and oil spills, and it just can make you just want to run home and just watch TV and eat french fries and not think about it. But hopefully, you know, in our 1 hour session or whatever, not like we're going to change lives, but at least maybe plant a seed that there's something that people can do, even as a young person. Yeah.
I hope I noticed right, but I noticed that you have bread sitting out most of the day with the mm-hmm. butter and peanut butter. Interested in the philosophy behind that, and also if there are other camps that do something like that, having food sit out on the counter for consumption.
I think for us it's a hospitality thing first and foremost. Just there's also milk and juice always in the reaching refrigerator, and just so that people can come feeling comfortable with the changes that they will inevitably encounter, especially if it's their first time here. There's a comfort level in knowing there's always bread and jam and peanut butter and fruit on the island. If I don't like the tempeh stir fry, I can have my peanut butter sandwich. And I think, I would say that's the main reason we do it. It's just that hospitality aspect. We don't want to force our diet upon anyone who would seriously be miserable eating it and maybe go hungry if that wasn't provided. But
yeah, just, I mean, I get hungry in the middle, between meals sometimes, and might have fruit or something, peanut butter, or, you know. So I think hospitality has a lot to do with it.
Are you able to do that in the summertime when you have 400 mm-hmm. some guests here? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Make more bread.
Yeah.
Molly?
Well, one that just reminded me, one of our challenges I think we're going to have over the next few years anyway, is with the Atkins diet, because we are a heavily bread-based and rice-based diet, grain-based, which is not, at least on the surface, consistent with an Atkins diet. And so we're looking at ways to be more educational of people who come in with protein concerns about alternative sources of protein that are on that diet, and but still have some. It will probably put celery out on the island so they can put their peanut butter on celery instead of bread, and make some changes like that. But I don't know if you're seeing that, especially with youth in camps, becoming a trend as well.
I don't know about. I noticed just in our synod this year with special diet requests for our Synod Assembly coming up.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly the Atkins. It's not, who could handle the vegetarian and the vegan? Oh.
Yeah.
If I could make a comment about this business of putting food out, related to our first session on hospitality, there's a sociologist that is writing and using the term refrigerator rights. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I worked at Lutheran Social Services and we had to have an outcome measure for foster care. When did foster care work, even though kids came from the Sudan or they came from Russia, all over the world? And if they said, how do you know when a child is bonded with their family? And they'd say, well, it's affection. They'd say, no, this is not going to work for Laotian kids. And then they'd say it would be another word and another this. The one thing that they found in common as a measurement of when a child had felt this was their home was when they went to the refrigerator without asking and took food and felt that it was their food. And I think to the extent that we have a system that doesn't let people have access to food, even in our camp settings and even here, without buying money out of a machine or the snack bar or the whatever, but that they can go up and take food on their own at whatever schedule, if it's midnight or whatever, of their choosing, and they have control over it rather than only what is passed to them or served. Hopefully that is one of the elements of hospitality, which is that you belong here. This is your home as well.
Your comments.
I very much enjoy the flavors of the foods. It's been really a treat. Your bread is amazing, you know, the flavors and so forth. The one thing that I wonder when I come is, what is it I'm eating? and there's not a lot of information about it, and I find it sitting around the table, you know, trying to talk to the locals, you know, what is this? So, provide people with information about what it is would be more enjoyable, just to know what it is I'm eating.
What did you eat
tonight? These are falafel with pita bread, and I think the lemon tahini dressing was labeled.
There was a label,
Maybe somebody doesn't know what tahini is.
You don't even know what falafel is.
It's in falafel.
Falafel is garbanzo beans, chickpeas, and they're, you know,
it's like cooked
and
spices.
Ground up and pounded. So that's amazing. And then tabbouleh was the last, like, it had bulk.
Do a hunger awareness meal year round. How many of you are doing that in the summer camp?
A hunger
awareness. I was telling Dan earlier today, I was meeting with this young woman in her 30s and on her estate planning, and said, what are your passions, or where would you like to get working on her will? And she said, when I was 8 years old, I went to this camp, and we learned about hunger, and we gave our money that day. We could choose bread for the world, and, the Lutheran hunger. And I've been passionate about hunger ever since, 8 years old, and it was really fun. So that's what she did. So it really makes a difference. Okay. Their comments. Who is our closing prayer before our song tonight? Joel. Anything else before Joel closes us, and then we'll close with the song? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Please pray. We thank you, O God, for the food you provide, and for our companions. We long for the day when no one is hungry and everyone is welcome to the table. Teach us to break bread with grateful hearts and to practice the generosity you share with us at your feast of life. In your gracious name we pray. Amen.
Let's sing on page 9 of the Green Songbooks. Let's get there.
Thank you. bounty.
About 15 minutes before you come over. Everyone is welcome to come. And it is post-Hole City to get from the hotel straight across between the two lodges to Chalet 4. So especially, I don't know how dark out it will be, it is actually a little bit easier to come to the road and go down the road and then up the Chalet Hill Road. And remember, until we get Chalet 2 built, our chalets are 1 through 4. So it's the third chalet. It's number 4. But I'm looking forward to having you all.
Sorry, just one under construction.